The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program, and I am your host. And welcome to the program. It's good to be here, and I'll tell you about our program in just a minute. But first, a couple of quick announcements. So the first announcement is that we're on the 60-minute format tonight, and therefore watch the clock, and if you have a question or a comment or a call or an email for our guest tonight, make sure you get it in time before we come up on that 60-minute point, and we appreciate that. The next short announcement is there will be no Hotel Mars program tomorrow for a whole variety of reasons. They're not important, but Hotel Mars is not going to be tomorrow. And then Sunday, everybody remember, it is open lines. First-time callers are certainly welcome. All space topics, science topics, STEM, STEAM are welcome, the topics you would like to talk about. So that is Sunday at noon, and we hope to hear from you. And calls are always preferred over email for open lines programs. So for tonight, our toll-free number, if you would like to call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air and answer it as quickly as possible. The line is turned off for the next few minutes as I make the announcements, but I'll let you know when it's turned on and you're able to get a call in. It is the preferred way of communicating with our guests, so again, it is 1-866-687-7223, but wait to call until I tell you it's turned back on. Email is also available, and that is drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And, you know, your emails are certainly welcome. We want to hear from you. And then you can also use the blog. And to do that, it is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. Open that page, which is also our archive page, and down at the bottom you can post a comment or ask a question. And as soon as you hit send or post it, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. But again, we do prefer toll-free, 1-866-687-7223. When you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, check out our detailed website newsletter. It's center right on the homepage, and it is new. It has all of the weeks shown there, all of the shows for the week shown there in detail. And also, if you scroll down, it shows you the programs we have scheduled between now and the end of the year. If you have a program you'd like us to do or a guest you'd like us to have on, especially this year, please email me the information at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're not totally sold out yet for 2018, but we are getting there. If you would like to subscribe to our short email version of the newsletter, make sure I have your email address and your wishes, and it goes out at 6 a.m. Monday morning. Everything we do is archived. You can listen quickly off of our website or very rapidly download our show. It is a holiday season, or it's almost upon us. We do have a store. It's in the upper left menu under support. You'll see it, Cafe Press. So if you have a favorite Space Show listener is interested in Space Show logo wear or something of that nature, please check it out. And always feedback and suggestions are welcome. To me, the most important information on the Space Show has to do with supporting the program. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with giantleapfoundation.org. And we are able to bring you these shows because we're listener-supported, and you do support us and you do financially contribute to the show. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you are a California taxpayer. Our parent 501c3 is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Do check it out. And if you have any questions about this or the nonprofit, then please do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I am working to get the new advisory board information posted so we can discuss it on Sunday for open lines. So if I get that up and posted, I'll post it on the blog for the Sunday open lines program, as some of you may be interested in the newly constituted and revised Space Shuttle One Giant Leap Foundation advisory board. And we do have sponsors. Their sponsor ads go across our homepage. You'll see their banner ads. You can change that banner ad as often as you like, and we're now opening up for sponsors for 2019. We only take a few of them because on longer shows we read a minute or so special message from each sponsor. It does eat a little bit into guest talk time, so we don't have an unlimited number of sponsors. We hold it to a minimum to not infringe upon guest talk time all that much. If you're interested for 2019, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do want to thank our sponsors tonight because we are doing the shorter form of the program. Northrop Grumman, we certainly thank and appreciate. The same for AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network, the National Space Society, the Space Plan with the Integrated Space System, and of course, the Space Foundation. We would not be doing the program without their great support, and we thank them very, very much. So it's been many, many years, way too long, since William or Bill Ketchum was the last time a guest on the Space Show. But Bill has a new book out, and he is on the show tonight, and it's great to talk to Bill again. He is an associate fellow of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, our sponsor, AIAA. He has written very many technical papers concerning the space program, and he has presented them at different international conferences. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering and a Master's in Aerospace Systems Management from USC. He worked for General Dynamics Space Systems Division, specializing in cryo-liquid propellant rockets and developing the Atlas and Centaur space launch vehicles. He participated in designing the space shuttle, and he conceived space-based orbit transfer vehicles for lunar and Mars missions. He was also involved in designing nuclear thermal rockets for human interplanetary missions. His military experience included Nike Zeus solid propellant rockets for intercepting incoming Russian ICBMs with thermonuclear warheads on them. His work is in astronautics and astrodynamics. His interests are in astrophysics and archaeology and anthropology and geology. He has traveled many times around the world, expanding his knowledge in all of these fields. He is a consultant for the next generation of space launch systems and has developed a small reusable personal space plane. Bill, welcome back to the program, and I understand you have a new book out. It's available on Amazon, To the Moon on a Slide Rule. Welcome back to the show, and it's great to be talking to you again. How are you?
Thank you, David. It's very nice that you invited me to be on your show again. It has been a while.
Absolutely. So did you really design and help take us to the moon using a slide rule?
It is amazing, isn't it? Because when I went to college, that was the first thing we were given. And we learned to operate this sliding piece of wood. And some were metal, some were wood. But that was the basic tool that I used. And, of course, this was used by many of my colleagues. Almost all engineers had them. And it wasn't until many years later that Texas Instruments and Hewlett-Packard came out with handheld calculators. There were computers used, but they were the large computers in huge rooms for doing much more complex calculations, but the slide rule was the tool. And I have to say that I understand even Buzz Aldrin took one of his small slide rules with him when he went to the moon. I just heard that recently. But, yes, hard to believe.
Was it as accurate as the calculators that came out, or did you tolerate being almost accurate, or you know, it's hard to imagine that the slide rule was as precise as the calculator. So I guess that's what I'm asking you. Was it close to being precise, or was it really precise?
It was precise enough to get us, you know, within the ballpark. Much of our calculations had to not be to the nth degree that calculators can run out to many, many digits. But for basic engineering work that we did, it was sufficient to get to, you know, a couple of decimal places.
Was it fast?
Very fast. In fact, you could do any kind of calculation. You couldn't do addition and subtraction, you know, and that was left for pencil and paper. But it did all sorts of multiplying and logarithmic and exponential. And I learned to operate it very fast. And I'm sure all my colleagues were as versed in it. And it was... it was just handy. You had it with you all the time. Some used to carry it on their belts, and I didn't. I thought that was not my style, but you probably saw some old photographs of engineers walking around with their slide rules attached to their belts.
What was your role in the early days of the space program? Did you go over to NASA, or did you stay with the rocket propulsion companies? What were you doing?
Well, actually, I even started out a little earlier. I was in college, and I was given the opportunity to be involved in a cooperative engineering program, which at that time you spent part of your time in college full-time, and then you spent part of your time working for a company. And I was chosen to go to Edwards Air Force Base and work in a flight test. I was only 19 years old at the time, and got hired by a company working with the Air Force, and that was Curtis Wright at the time. They were making a jet engine under license from the British. It was for some of us that are older probably remember the J-65 Sapphire gas turbine engine used in many military aircraft. So I got started there, and then when I went back to college, I saw that space activity was starting to ramp up. And so when I graduated, I went to work for General Dynamics Convair in San Diego and was hired into the Atlas ICBM program as a rocket propulsion engineer in working with a liquid propellant kerosene and liquid oxygen Atlas, which was the first ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, to compete against the Russians, which later became a space launch vehicle. But my first part of my career was working with a weapon system. And then, of course, we added on top of the Atlas the Centaur upper stage, which was the first upper stage powered by liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. It's still used today on top of the Atlas V, which is now, oh my gosh, how many successful launches. Mm-hmm. In the early days, of course, every other launch could have a problem. Nowadays, it's amazing the number of successful launches. Things have changed a lot. I know I've gone on here, so you probably have questions.
Well, did you do anything with the moon program? Were you involved anyway there, or did you stay with the Atlas?
No, the Atlas became a space launch vehicle, and it was the vehicle chosen for the Mercury astronauts.
Right.
In fact, John Glenn was launched on top of an Atlas. Then we added the Centaur, and the first missions for the Centaur on top of the Atlas were to send a Surveyor spacecraft to the moon to soft land to check out whether or not the surface of the moon was several feet of, or some people thought it would be covered with dust such that it would just sink out of sight. Well, that course landed and just found a very small layer of dust, and so it pioneered the landings for the Apollo later. So the Atlas and the Centaur really was instrumental in paving the way to the Apollo landers, and yes, I was involved in that program. And many others after that.
Listeners, we do have the telephone line open if you want to give us a call. It is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Again, it is available right now. And email remains available, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Tell us a little bit about your book. What does it cover? What period of time does it cover?
Well, it's kind of an amazing thing. I, of course, worked 35 years in the space business and retired actually at 56 and started doing a lot of things that I hadn't been able to do, traveling a lot, and I actually had spent most of my life in San Diego, and I decided to try something quite different. So I bought a small ranch in Idaho and moved up there and did a lot of traveling. And anyway, came back to San Diego because it's just a great place to live, and I missed not being near the water. But I would say 6 years or so after I retired, I started writing just about almost anything and that came to mind. And I self-published short stories over about the next 10 years at one per year, never intending to really do anything with them. I just had them available for my family and friends. And then I kind of set that aside, and I bought a sailboat. I lived on that. I traveled a lot. And then I got to thinking, all these books about different things, some about my career, some about my travels, some about my life, early life, my family. So it's a combination of everything that's happened to me, and about half of it, I guess, is the space career. The other half is about my life. Anyway, all these 10, 11 different short stories I gathered together, only after, four of my friends independently encouraged me to do this. And as one put it, kind of like the stars aligned. I think that's a pretty good description. And so I had all these elements, but I didn't know how to organize them. I mean, they were all about different things, but then there was some duplication. So I took them to Office Depot and scanned them into PDF and had all these things now on PDF, and then I converted it to Word. And a friend of mine, who's also an author and a editor, I asked him, well, how do I get all this stuff put together in some kind of a format that, you know, will make sense and people can read and enjoy it? So he said, well, take each element and put a couple of words on little cards and then sit down on the floor and put them down there and start moving them around into what you think is the best format. So I did this, and it worked out pretty well. So then I made a list of what I thought the organization should be, and I gave it to my friend along with all the word scans, which were, you know, completely unorganized. But all the material was there. Well, he took about 6 hours and put it all in order into a document, which then I gave to a friend of mine who is a published author, and he is a technical writer, and he offered to edit it. And so he did that and just did a great job. And I think it's, of course, personally, I think it turned out really well. And then I had a friend that had helped me publish another book about my great-grandfather in the Civil War. And he took all that that was edited, and converted it into book form to publish on Amazon Kindle, and he created the cover, and just, you know, it's like everybody came together and helped me. I don't think that you know, the book would have ever been published without all these people offering to help me. And, you know, it's just, well, I feel good about it. And I want to thank them so much. And I'm actually having a book signing party coming up on next Saturday in San Diego at the clubhouse where I live, and they'll be there, and hoping to have a really good time, and I'll have books there. Excuse me.
Where can they get information on the specifics of where the book signing is?
Okay, well, it's called Friars Village.
Friars Village?
Friars Village, like Friar Tuck.
Okay.
It's in San Diego, and if you Google Friars Village, it'll come up with a website, and it will tell you everything you need to know. It's at 1 o'clock on this coming Saturday, 1 to 5, and I'll have books, and I think, well, 25 people have said they're coming. I hope more.
Is it at a store at Friars Village?
It's at the clubhouse, you drive in, follow your GPS map or whatever you have, and as you come in, turning off the main street, it will be right in front of you as you come to a T intersection. So Park anywhere and come to the party. We'll have refreshments and, everything, some food. And you'll be able to meet, hopefully, a lot of my colleagues, aerospace engineers or quote-unquote rocket scientists, and a lot of friends of mine from different walks of life, and my family. And so come and join in.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How are you tonight?
Very good. You mentioned that the surveyor mission and the early concern about that the moon would be, you know, so full of dust that people would sink into it. It reminded me of a book that I read back in high school by Arthur C. Clarke called A Fall of Moon Dust, which was based on the concept that somebody, they had this vehicle that traveled across the moon and it fell into a sinkhole full of dust and was buried.
I don't remember that one, but I did read a lot of science fiction, Ray Bradbury and so on, in the past, as I was growing up as a teenager. And of course, there were a lot of different stories, and there was some fear that because of the billions of years of bombardment on the moon, that it would have pulverized the surface and created a huge depth of dust. And that wasn't really put to bed until their surveyor landed. So I feel that we really did contribute to that. But your mention of that story, I would like to read that someday. Maybe you could give us the title of it.
It's called A Fall of Moon Dust, and it's by Arthur C. Clarke, and it's available on Amazon.
Okay, great.
So that's one source you might find. I don't know where else you'd find it. There are websites I know that sell, you know, used books too and all that, and I get them.
Right.
Hey, John.
Got surplus from the library.
John, did you use a slide rule in your earlier years?
Oh, yeah. In high school, of course, you know, which in my period, yeah, they used slide rule, like in the chemistry class and the physics class through calculations, at least, and then in college. I wasn't exactly a well-to-do person financially during that period, so I didn't actually get a calculator until, I think it was almost my senior year. It was a birthday present from my mother. But I do remember when they first became available my freshman year, that some of the more affluent kids had the HP 35, I think it was, and there was a guy in a calculus class, and back in those days they had this technique. They'd teach how to use differentials to estimate, like cube roots and stuff like that. And they teach that, and they write the professors up there very knowingly saying, well, can you take the cube root of this number, right? And then and what would that be? And the some kid punches it in and tells them what it is.
Yeah, they were very very effective. And as you say, the HPs and Texas Instrument handheld calculators didn't come out until the mid-70s, I think. And of course, we'd already landed on the moon before that, so we didn't have those available to us. But once the handheld calculators came out, these slide rules were doomed, and hardly anybody knows about them. the current generation of engineers, I'm not sure we know about them or how to use them. But they're in museums now, and I happen to have mine still.
Well, you can buy new ones. They're still available if you want to order them on the Internet.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. So somebody wants to try them out, and they come with a good instruction book, and it's fun.
What were you going to say, John?
Yeah, I think my first was the TI-50. I think that's my mother got for me. But yeah, but I think the HP-35, when they first came out, they were, and the 45, they were both very expensive at the time. I mean, in the, you know, in today's money, if you ask like the $300 or $400 it was then to today's money, I mean, that's.
I agree. And in fact, General Dynamics, the company I worked for, they, offered the employees a way to buy them on time, so that they'd take a small amount out of your paycheck each time, and it didn't make it so you know, hard to swallow. But I bought my first HP 35 when they came out, and it changed everything. Slide rule, I still used it because I was so fluent in it, and it was very comfortable to make calculations.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the olden days, you know, if you go way back, and that would even be before my time, a lot of calculations that people did in science and all were, actual arithmetic was a big part of the problem in those days for complicated problems, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the slide rules, you can do anything with them that involve multiplication, division, exponentials, logarithms, you know, it's really amazing.
Yeah. And I thought that was interesting, that when you mentioned that thing about the idea of the moon to be so covered with dust, you just sink into it. I just remember that story. It was just kind of interesting.
Anything
else?
I mean,
it basically deals with the rescue, only how the people end up getting rescued and all from that situation.
Yeah. Anything else, John? Otherwise, I'll move on.
Let's move on.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Listeners, John has freed up our phone line. It is 1-866-687-7223 if you want to call. Josh is in Tucson with an email, and he said, Bill, when David introduced you, caller, you're on hold, so please be patient. When David introduced you, he mentioned your nuclear propulsion experience. We're hoping that there is a rejuvenation of nuclear propulsion in today's world. Do you follow it, and what do you think of the latest efforts to try to get nuclear propulsion in place?
Well, I've always been a proponent of it. I worked on the Mars missions after the Apollo lunar landing. There was plans to go to Mars, and so General Dynamics had some study contracts with NASA, and back then they had already tested the Nerva and the Phoebus solid core uranium nuclear engines. And very successfully, they were a bit heavy. And so later on, the Mars mission never happened. It wasn't affordable back then after the Apollo moon landings. NASA had several options they were looking at, and they chose the space shuttle as the least costly development. But nevertheless, later on in my career, I worked with the Air Force Systems Command in Albuquerque on a more efficient nuclear rocket engine. And that was under the Star Wars project, Timberwind, it was called at the time, and it was a particle bed nuclear rocket engine, and I worked on that for a while. just before I retired, actually. And that was very interesting program. Not sure exactly what's happening nowadays. I know that there is a resurgence of interest in nuclear propulsion. I believe it's really crucial to future manned missions to the planets, to Mars. Right now, you know, a Hohmann transfer takes 9 months, and then you stay there for a while, and then it's 9 months back, so it could be as long as 3 years total. If you have a nuclear rocket engine and double the performance of any propellant that we now have, approaching 1,000 seconds, whereas hydrogen oxygen is a little less than 500 seconds, it just makes a huge difference. And you've got power to spare, and instead of using it, you know, for, you can actually use it to get to Mars quicker. There have even been studies made that you could do it in like a month instead of 9 months. I'm sure that there are engineers working on it right now, and I believe that we've really got to be able to travel fast for numerous reasons. You know, just 9 months of coasting exposed to you know, all the radiation and everything that you're going to have. So I think in probably the studies that are made, trade-offs are going to be made against fast versus slower with more radiation protection, and of course all the problems of just life support for that amount of time. Anyway, that's what I would have, if I were still working, I would be very encouraged to continue.
All right. You have another caller, so let's take your call. Hi, caller. Thank you for waiting. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
And I'm out here in Renfro, Oklahoma. Anyway, the previous conversation on slide rule, love it. Yes, I had to give up a slide rule for my first electronic calculator, an IBM 1130 computer. It only weighed about 2,000 pounds.
Right.
And, gee, when I did my first programming, there was a lot of impressed people, but, you know, it was kind of silly. But the key point I want to bring up is, I understand the Saturn V was basically built by slide rule, and the key thing is the engineering precision that you get by going from slide rule to computer. The engineering margins and so on like that keep getting smaller and smaller. In fact, the last major computer I worked on, we were doing quad precision floating points, you know, 128-bit. Floating point
wow.
Precision, and it's kind of like I felt at the time that was a little overboard, but on the
mm-hmm.
other hand, whenever we come in there and build these new rocket engines and new rockets and so on, is that absolutely required to be that precise?
Good question. I think that since we actually did accomplish what we did, with the slide rules, it almost answers the question for you. Going to more and more decimal points, you know, it buys you more accuracy, but does it really make that much of a difference? I think that in the work I did, having a couple of decimal points was sufficient. And it's a different world now. I mean, I started out actually a few months before Sputnik, I was hired into General Dynamics Condor and working on the Atlas. And then I continued my career for the next 35 years. So I was actually born at the right time and the right place to do this. And I felt that most everything that I was responsible for and that had to be done correctly, I could do it on my slide rule. We did have, like you mentioned, your other computer being so big. We had an entire building in San Diego dedicated to the IBM 704. And, I mean, it was an entire building. And it had banks and banks of, well, they weren't vacuum tubes. They'd gone beyond that. But the heating, cooling of the computer was one of the biggest items that had to be done. They had these huge air conditioning systems. And now all that is basically in your pocket.
It's in your cell phone.
Yes, it's hard to believe. I mean, I've seen things change so much that it just amazes me, and I'm expecting them to change even more. I'm hoping to be around to see all that.
Yeah. Did you ever get to use the computer-aided design systems like AutoCAD?
I didn't actually get into that. That came along toward the end of my career.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have used some of it, but for my own work that I've done on my space plane that I worked on and is now in a museum, but AutoCAD, I think, is what I had some, and somebody was helping me with that, but I never really used computer-aided design. Back in the days up until I retired, we still had drafting boards and guys, you know, laying down pencil on vellum.
Oh, geez. that strikes me right through the heart, because I was one of the people that did introduced a lot of the CAD work at General Dynamics, only it was at Fort Worth on the F-16. The key thing I would like to end with is the fact that they built the Saturn V using slide rules and so on like that. And the human mind is a heck of a lot more important than the computer tools, because the computer by itself doesn't do anything. But the precision just helps things go so much faster. And that's why we can move much faster from, I guess you'd say, from Falcon 1, Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, and BFR.
Oh, and what's going on at SpaceX and Blue Origin and Richard Branson's, I would say the three of those, Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos, that is the future. And it's amazing to see. I've been up to SpaceX in Hawthorne about three times, and I'm just amazed when I go into the engineering area and it's dim light. There are hundreds of engineers, technicians, and so on working at their desks with monitors in front of them. There's not a drafting board to be seen anywhere.
And no lead pencils.
No lead pencils, no paper. I mean, it's almost like I've lived in two different, I have
cultures.
Two different centuries,
Well, actually, it almost is two centuries. Anyway, enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you found my questions interesting.
Thank you, Marshall.
I did.
Bye.
Thank you.
Listeners, Marshall has given up our phone line. if you would like to call, and there still is time to get a call in, 1-866-687-7223. The gentleman that was calling before the show started, before we had the lines turned on, I hope you're listening, and you give us a call. I'm sorry you called before we got the lines turned on and set up. But again, it is 1-866-687-7223. And he is calling, the same gentleman. So.
Oh, great.
Good evening. Thank you for waiting. And your name is, and where are you calling from, please?
My name's Bob. I'm calling from just a little north of San Diego, and I used to work for Bill.
Oh, and you're still friends?
Believe it or not, yes.
I remember, Bob, you came in from UCSD, I think, in... 1972 or somewhere along there.
1970, yeah.
Wow.
But,
yeah.
But I brought my slide roll with me.
So I know. You did a lot.
I really appreciate everything you're saying. You know, I guess one thing, Bill, is you're doing yourself a disservice because, you know, that you were an excellent program manager for us. The way you're talking now, I think people will understand how calm and measured you were in your responses to things. So it really meant a lot to us young engineers that were working for you. The one thing I remember about some of the stuff you did is you had about two, three ring binders that you called the Book of Knowledge.
Mm.
And you would loan those out to us young engineers, and we would pour through them. And unbeknownst to you, I would make copy of all the pages, and I made my own Book of Knowledge from that. And now I've got 9 volumes of that.
Wow, yeah. No, I remember that. Yeah, you were very interested in my notebooks, and I had tried to put all kinds of things in there, and you worked on some of my projects, and of course, you were amongst the new wave of engineers, and then we had, I was assigned a job of managing a whole group of young engineers right out of college, and we tried to interest NASA in new systems and all, and those engineers, well, you know, Tom and Mike, and they've kept in touch with me over the years. I'm hoping that they'll attend this party. I hope you are coming.
I plan to.
Great. Oh, it'll be great to see you again. And
So other than that, I didn't really have a question. I just wanted to. Basically, thank you for all the time.
Bob, are you still working in the industry?
Yes, I am, actually. I'm still working. I retired, but I'm on contract to NASA for some of the programs they're doing in some of the future projects, one that's called Gateway that's thinking about establishing a way station in a lunar orbit around the moon. As a way station to go to the surface and on to Mars.
Yeah, we're very familiar with that on the space show. It's not a popular project on the space show.
I don't really understand why it's not popular. It's been pushed around for several years now. You know, it's a way to get to the lunar surface and a way to get to Mars, and NASA's struggling to put their arms around it.
Yeah, nobody believes they're going to the lunar surface. They say, if you go to the lunar surface, go to the lunar surface. We don't need a gateway where only SLS can reach it. So that's some of the animosity about it that I hear all the time whenever it comes up on the show.
Don't tell the Russians that. They're expecting to go there also.
Well, the news on that is that they're thinking of bailing out because they don't want to go there either, teaming up with the Chinese. So we've been covering that story on the space show quite a bit. So don't hold your breath.
I don't hold my breath on anything aerospace.
Boy, not in this business.
That's a good rule of thumb. Was that in the Book of Knowledge, Bill? Don't ever hold your breath.
I think that was one of the chapters there.
Associated to it says, don't hold your breath.
That's right. That's as good today as it was 50 years ago or whenever.
Exactly. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much for your call. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. I'll see you, Bob.
Bye.
So, listeners, Bob has freed up the line, and you're still welcome to give us a call if you have time, or an email, 866-687-7223. What do you think we should be doing with today's space program? Should we be getting our butts onto Mars with people? Should we be going back to the moon? Should we do something in LEO? If you could run the space program, given your perspective and all of your experience, what would you have us do?
Well, right now, we spend one half of 1% of the federal budget on NASA. In other words, $19 billion per year out of $3,800 billion. That's one half of 1%.
Right.
Amazing. If we increase that to 1%, we could do all these things. And I'm proposing, or have proposed in my book, that we do this. I'm not sure that that's going to meet with much success, but if we were to double NASA's budget to 1% or it's almost $40 billion, well, just imagine what we could do with that. We could come up with a second-generation space shuttle. We could establish a base on the moon, and we could start toward Mars. I don't see any reason why this can't be done. The technology there, it's the money and the impetus to do it, and there's a lot of politics involved in that. So I have proposed that we do the, or try and get the budget increased. And my gosh, we could be doing what we had done during the Apollo program.
Have you ever talked about this or proposed it to your representatives in San Diego or either of our two senators?
No. In fact, I just now published my book, and that was in the last chapter that I wrote. And I have also sent a letter to some of the newspapers trying to get it published and mentioning it there. But it's fairly recent that I've been doing this. So this is probably the first time that I guess it will go out into the cosmos. I'm probably putting my reputation on the line by proposing such a grandiose plan, knowing that there's a lot of emphasis in trying to reduce the budget. But see, if we can't afford 1% of the federal budget to do what NASA can do, I just don't understand that. I think that the public is interested in it because I have given talks at UCSD here in San Diego, and most of the questions say, why aren't we doing more? When are we going to come up with a replacement for the space shuttle? And, you know, using the knowledge we learned what not to do on the previous space shuttle, come up with a second generation shuttle. And why not go back to the moon? And what about Mars? You know, there's a lot of interest, but for some reason, it just doesn't get into the political area that is required. You got to get Congress to sponsor it. And
why don't you invite your San Diego County representative to come to your book signing event, or one of their staffers? Maybe they'll send a staffer.
Hmm.
It's an election year. They're all up for nomination.
Yeah.
The House gets reelected every 100% every 2 years. So
good idea.
Don't tell them there'll be 25 people, though. Tell them there'll be 2,500 people there. Do what, do what they do, which is lie all the time.
A lot of
does.
Voters, yeah.
Yeah, just lie, lie back to them, and maybe somebody will come.
We're coming up on the midterm elections. I don't know that there are very many politicians that are, you know, interested or concerned in a space program.
No, not at all. It's unfortunate. We talk about this all the time on the
show. I know.
But
it's
not a campaign issue, even if people are interested in it.
And Trump is trying to cut the budget. He's asked for all elements to reduce by 5%, and reducing NASA's budget by 5% is going to hurt.
Well, I know, but look, I mean, they're coming up on, what, $21 or $22 trillion? I mean, it's just, when you were probably working, you know, way back when, you know, think of what the national debt was at that time, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we do have other problems, but I'm a space guy, and I guess I can propose these things. Whether or not people accept what I'm saying or not, it doesn't bother me in my advanced age here. So we'll see what happens.
Other people propose it too. I would like somebody to listen to it and run with it. What else should we ask you about in the remaining time regarding your book or any other announcements or information you want to share with us?
Well, about my book, as I said, it's a combination of my career and the things I worked on. And the other part of it is about my life. And there's a lot of things that happen along the way that they are some amusing, some, you know, serious, some funny, there's things in there about my family, and so that is a combination memoir, autobiography, and so on. I think that the cover might be misleading. People look at To the Moon, and they see a picture of a slide rule and the Earth and the Moon. They might think it's just about space, but it's not. It's about life. And I think that there may be some elements of it that hit on other people that have experienced the same things. I grew up during World War II. I was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. And for the next 4 years, my father was gone, and my mother was busy with the USO, and my sister didn't, being 6 years older. So it was an interesting time to grow up. And so there's some of those things in the book, too. But I think it might resonate with other people and their lives.
You have another caller. Let me put that caller through to you, okay?
Okay.
Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, I'm another Bob that he knows.
Ah, Bob Henson.
You got it, Bill.
How are you doing, Bob?
Oh, pretty good. Good to hear you on a nationwide radio show.
Well, you are, too. You're on there.
Worldwide, Bob. You're on the Internet. It's worldwide.
Oh, okay, great. Well, Bill and I have known each other since 1958.
Yes, we have.
He escorted me into my job at General Dynamics Convair on a day when we got drenched in a rainstorm in San Diego.
A torrential rainstorm. That's the way I introduced you to the world.
Well, we've known each other ever since and been good friends. I worked for General Dynamics, different divisions, names, but for 36 years. And one of my, I started on the Atlas. Bill was working on that. And when I first walked out and saw the mock-up, I went, oh, my God, I couldn't believe it.
I know. I felt the same way.
And then in about 1960, Centaur program came along, and I was assigned to work on that. So I was in on the ground floor for Centaur. Bill may not know the exact number, but the last Atlas V launch was the 250th launch of the Centaur.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So, that is amazing, and it's still the most efficient upper stage.
Exactly. Yeah. The balloon tank structure is about as efficient as you can get as far as structural weight on an upper stage.
Yeah, I think that the Vulcan plan by ULA and Lockheed Martin is going to continue using that technology because it is so efficient. And so the Centaur will go on for who knows how long. It's really something to have worked on such an advanced concept that's now still being used.
Right. And people have thought very deeply about how can we make it lighter than that, and nobody's come up with a better answer. So that design has been around since the first flight was 62.
Hey. Yeah, and it was based on the Atlas balloon tankage before that. So, yeah, it's really amazing.
Well, Bill and I have been conversing lately about things like the space launch system. And both of us feel that the space launch system is a rocket ship without a mission. And but not only that, it is based on pre-existing designs. There's no new technology, hardly any new technology involved.
Do you have your computer speakers on in the background, Bob? Because you need to cut it off. Because we're getting a lot of feedback.
Hmm. Oh, it is off.
Your computer speakers are not on?
No, I have them muted.
I wonder if we're picking them up on muting. Because we're getting feedback. Okay, well, go on. We're getting some feedback someplace with the show in the background.
Well, I'll just shut the thing off if then. Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people don't like SLS, but it's still going forward, isn't it?
Well, it's called the Senate Launch Vehicle also.
Right, yeah, of course.
And that's exactly correct. It's there to keep the people in NASA and especially at Marshall Space Flight Center employed. And that's his primary reason. And people like Musk and SpaceX and other newcomers, quote unquote, in this business are going to overtake that kind of thing. NASA is just not going to be able to compete with the commercial people. Cost or performance or anything else. Those are the people that are going to be controlling our future launch vehicle designs. They're innovative, they're bold, and they want to go down new paths instead of continuing on with the old warmed over designs.
That is largely true. What you say, it's a new era of entrepreneurs, and you got Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos, and others. It's going to be a new world. It's going to be not like it was.
That's exactly correct, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, I hope we get to see some of this stuff happen. So that's it seems to be dragging. So, you know, I'd like to see a lot more progress made a lot more rapidly. So.
Well, Bill and I are sort of impatient because we're getting pretty much on the old side. I have a birthday this week, and I'll be 85.
Well, you guys are got it on me, but I'm getting restless, too, in my early 70s. So.
Well, thanks for having Bill on your show.
Okay, and thank you very much for your call. We certainly appreciate hearing from you.
I'll see you at the party, Bob, okay?
I'll be there.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you. Goodbye. Do you have any summary statements, any closing comments, anything other than the party coming up where you're going to have both of our senators and your representative there?
Well, you came up with that suggestion just now. I guess I'm going to have to get on the line.
Yeah, don't hold your breath. That's another use of your rule,
right.
The rule book.
Right. I think they're concerned with other things.
Yeah, well,
and,
I guess so, but they should be concerned about this too, so...
Well, I'm hoping maybe if one of the newspapers picks up my article that I've written, I probably should send you a copy of it.
Or if you know how to post it, you can post your article on our blog. Or if you don't know how to do it, just send me the article or the link to the article if it's on the San Diego newspaper, and I'll post it on the blog for you.
Well, I'm hoping that it's published by... one of the big newspapers, but the chances are slim.
Well, we can cut and paste it to the blog, and if you want to do it, fine. If you want me to do it, I'm happy to do it for you.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll
just get it to me, and I'll put it up there.
Okay. I'll probably wait a couple of days, see if I get any response from the New York Times or, you know, Wall Street Journal or something, but chances are pretty slim. There's not a lot of interest, as you know.
Right. Well, it's hard to get to, and of course, other things are crowding it out right now. As
say. For sure.
Plus the midterm. So.
Right.
All right.
And as far as the other thing you mentioned, besides my book, I'm. Talked about my party coming up, and I would invite anybody in the San Diego area to come and join in. It'll be hopefully a bunch of old gray-haired rocket scientists, aerospace engineers.
Well, maybe you get some young engineers coming too. I mean, you want the young blood too.
That's right. Well, Bob Ford's coming, and so that's a new generation, and. Yeah, I do hope that younger ones come. I've put out a lot of emails to a lot of different people of different generations, so hopefully they'll come, and I think it'll be a great opportunity to exchange views and see what might be done, and so... Anybody coming? It's going to be Saturday, 1 o'clock on the 27th at the Friars Village Clubhouse. And if you Google it, they'll give you a website and instructions.
Okay, we'll put it in the summary of the show. Well, listen,
okay.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, and. I hope a lot of people show up, and we'll get this archived and all of this information up by tomorrow morning, first thing. And let us know when you write your next book.
Well, I tell you, this has been a great, a lot of enjoyment I've had on your program.
Okay.
And talking, answering questions from other people, and I think we've covered a lot of territory, and of course, I wasn't, you know, sure how things were going to go, but I feel that I haven't made any big misstatements or anything like that. I always, you know, worry about that. But
no, we're good to go, and
I really thank you, David, for inviting me on your show, and. Again, it has been a few years since I was last on. Actually, I was on with Hugh Davis.
That's right, a long time ago.
Long time ago.
And he's no longer with us, so.
I think that's true, yeah, because I haven't gotten any response for any emails.
No, he departed several years ago. I remember when that happened, a very sad event. But
yeah, he was a very good engineer. In fact, we both started out at Edwards Air Force Base about the same time during the, you know, test pilots that became astronauts.
Uh-huh.
The Right Stuff is a really good book to read, or the movie. It's really quite accurate.
Absolutely. All right, listen, Bill, we will talk to you soon, I hope, and good luck at your book signing, and let's stay in touch, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you very much again, and you're doing a great thing getting out the information.
Okay.
Good job you're doing.
Thank you. And listeners, remember there will be no Hotel Mars tomorrow. Our next program is Friday morning, and then Sunday is Open Line. Everybody, thank you for calling. And those of you who emailed us, his book is available on Amazon, and I really recommend it. You'll enjoy it very much. And it's much broader, as he said, than just the topic of a slide rule. Everyone have a great night, and thank you for Bill, for David, and the Space Show.